I am so glad it is Friday.
Yay.
Hi, everybody. I hope you had a mellow week.
We did.
Yeah, yeah. Glad to be back live with y'all. We were out last week. We had been away. Heidi and I were actually touring Louisiana with my band, The Last Hombres. Had a lot of fun. It was hard work. Coming back was much harder work. but the week is over, and it's 5 p.m.,
it was
so
worth
it's time to put your feet up, or at least get home and maybe do the same. Congratulations for making it to Friday, and I hope you have a good weekend ahead of you. As you know, we do the new format for Friday from our show for American Hit Network. We call it How Music Changed. We've started a series a few weeks ago dedicated to the history of Eric Clapton. We have so far dedicated 6 shows to Eric Clapton and his musical history. So today is show number 7. As we start today's show, we start at the beginning of his solo career, and it's worth mentioning at this point in time to kick off the show that the thing that has caused Clapton to move from one thing to another has been dissatisfaction and anxiety, it seems. It seems like every band that he had been in, he left because he was unhappy with the band. He left the Yardbirds because he didn't like the direction that they were going in. He left Cream because he wasn't happy with their musical direction and with the dynamic among the band members. He was in Blind Faith for a blink of an eye, was out before the band even had a chance to develop any sort of real repertoire. They only had one album. And when he left them, he left them so quickly. What he had left to do was to go on tour with the band that was opening for Blind Faith.
Right.
He'd go on tour with Blind Faith, and he'd spend most of the show just watching Delaney and Bonnie and being enraptured with their musicianship and the players that were in their band, wishing that he was playing with them, and spent all of his time really with them more than with his own group. So when the opportunity came for him to play with Delaney and Bonnie, he just up and went and did it, which left Ginger Baker and Stevie Winwood scratching their heads like, what?
What just happened?
Right. But the significant thing that you have to keep in mind here at this exact point in time is that what Clapton just did when he jumped ship was he just jumped ship from playing with English musicians to play with American musicians. This was the huge appeal to him, you say.
Mm-hmm.
Just like all of the blues players were emulating the American blues players from, you know, throughout history, usually black players, Clapton was just really totally falling in love with the whole American scene. It wasn't a matter, it never really was about race at all. It was really just about the authenticity of what American musicians were offering. And he saw that on stage night after night with Delaney and Bonnie, which made him incredibly pleased to be able to sit in with them as a sideman. He was happier there than he was as being a leader of these other English bands, because he always felt that what he was doing in those situations was more or less playing pretend. Here with Delaney and Bonnie, he felt like he was in with the real deal and that he was learning to become what he really did emulate to be. He was happy. And it was this situation that led him to basically consider his solo career, because he had just found musicians who he thought would be appropriate to back him if he made a solo album, meaning the American musicians. Here's how he takes it. Again, we're going to be reading excerpts from Clapton's autobiography entitled Simply Clapton. Here's how he puts it. Delaney persuaded me to cut a solo album with him as producer, and we started to work on it at Amigo Studio. I had only written one song, Let It Rain, but Delaney had a few, or we'd be on the way to the studio in the morning, and Delaney would say, What about a song about a bottle of red wine? And he would start singing, Get up and get your man a bottle of red wine. It would just flow out of him. And by the time we got to the studio, the song would be finished. I remember thinking to myself, how does he do it? He just opens up his mouth and out comes a song. We'd go straight into the studio and record it live. Then I would put a couple of vocal tracks down with Delaney coaching me, and then it would be time for the girls and the horns. Rita and Bonnie would be given their part, and they'd sing it. Jim and Bobby would put some riffs on, and that was the whole thing wrapped up. It was fantastic, and I was in my element, recording my own album with the best band in the land. Delaney had brought something out in me that I didn't know I had. Here's a track from that first solo album. It was entitled simply Eric Clapton. The track is called Bad Boy.
I'm just a bad boy. I'm the cat that scratches and I'm like a dog that bites. I'll be your box of matches, baby, when you need a light. I'm just a bad boy. Long, long ways from home. But I ain't got nobody to bury me when I'm dead and gone. Stay here no longer. My luck is running slow. Gotta keep on moving, but I ain't got no place to go. I'm just a bad boy, long, long ways from home. I'm just a bad boy.
Funny that it wasn't until this point in his career that Clapton actually felt as though he was truly a valid writer and singer. Up until this point, I mean, he was able to write with Delaney Bramlett and Bonnie Bramlett. He had such respect for them that he felt, I guess, empowered by their acceptance of him, which was such a turn of the cards. But you know, he was essentially, I guess, relatively insecure about where he fit in the world musically as an Englishman and getting, I'll tell you what, I mean, I'm probably thinking about this because I think about my own situation being like a Northerner, a New Yorker, going down to Louisiana to play music. You know, you really think that when you do something like that, you're bringing sand to the beach. You know, what, they do it already so well, why would they need me?
Yeah, so you're not the first person to come down there and play music. There are a lot of people that move down there and play music.
Right, but that applies to Eric Clapton as well. Of course, there's lots of people, but if you have a genuine deep respect for American music, you want to find yourself embroiled in the middle of it to feel that sense of validity. It makes you feel good about what you're doing, as opposed to just, you know, feeling as though you're an outsider and wishing you could join the club. So it has to be the way that he felt about it.
Right.
So, you know, so he's playing with people like, you know, Jim Gordon, the drummer, Carl Radle, the bass player, all these great Southerners, Bobby Whitlock on, you know, piano and organ, Leon Russell on piano is part of the thing. And then horn players like Jim Price and Bobby Keys. So, you know, just he had himself exactly, you know, where he wanted to be. As he goes on in his book, my solo career really began there. I knew I had it in me, really, but I had stuffed it down to the point that I had stopped believing in myself. I'll never be able to repay Delaney for his belief in me. He saw something I had stopped looking for in myself. Making that record is one of the most important steps I would ever take, and it was a truly memorable experience. I remember going in one day when we didn't have a song planned, and Leon Russell came up to me and said, "I've got a line for you." And thinking aloud, he said, "You're a blues musician, but people don't know that you can also rock and roll. So we can say, I bet you didn't think I knew how to rock and roll. Oh, I got the boogie-woogie right down in my very soul. There ain't no need for me to be a wallflower, because now I'm living on blues power." Just like that, with no effort. And that was the birth of the song Blues Power, one of my favorite songs on the album. That explains exactly why it's credited to Eric Clapton and Leon Russell.
Amen.
Here's that track.
You didn't think I knew how to rock and roll. Oh, I got the boogie woogie right down in my very soul. There ain't no need for me to be a flower, 'cause now I'm living on blues power. Time, but now I'm gonna let you know. I'm gonna keep on rocking, no matter if it fails to slow. Ain't gonna stop until the 25th hour. Midnight, we don't let it all hang down.
some action. We gon' get some satisfaction. We gon' find out what it is all about. After midnight, we gon' let it all hang down. After midnight, we gon' shake your tambourine. After midnight, so go be peaches and cream. No false talk and suspicion. We gon' give an exhibition. We gon' find out what it is all about.
Two tracks from the album entitled Eric Clapton. Two songs that would be, I guess, two of the most popular songs on the album, songs that he would revisit again and again in his career. Those versions in particular, though, are best loved by most, I suppose. They've got that Delaney Bramlett production with the cool horn bits and everything else in the background, singers, and of course, that, you know, Bonnie backing them up and Rita Coolidge, and a lot of strength to it there. It's kind of cool. The thing was that makes this confusing from a latter day perspective, meaning from today's point of view, looking back at it. If you're a person who's trying to figure out Clapton's discography, say, and you're interested in, you know, the start of his solo work, well, yes, the album Eric Clapton is his first solo album, released in August of 1970. But it got really confusing within a couple of years. Because already all these compilation records began to follow hot on its heels around the early 70s, because there was a time when Clapton took a break. We'll get to that point. We didn't quite reach there yet. But when he took a hiatus from playing for a while, all of these labels began to release a whole slew of compilation albums that all seemed to basically duplicate the material from around this time. One of the first ones to come out was a double album set called The History of Eric Clapton. And on that were a bunch of early songs going back to the beginning of his career, songs from Cream and right on, and up to songs from this album, like songs like I Don't Want to Discuss It, Blues Power, Teasin', and some of his stuff with Derek and the Dominoes. Soon after that album came out, there was on Polydor put out this really unusual thing where they would put out a double album set, each album dedicated to the three members of Cream. So there was an album called Ginger Baker at His Best, an album called Jack Bruce at His Best, and another album called Eric Clapton at His Best. And again, it was a compilation of mostly stuff from around this era, with a lot of the Delaney and Bonnie songs. Bottle of Red Wine is on that. Let It Rain, Blind Faith stuff. And again, more Derek and the Dominoes stuff. If that weren't enough to cause confusion, immediately after that, Polydor released another single compilation album, this one called Simply Clapton.
Reminiscent of like what the Rolling Stones.
Yeah, exactly. Very reminiscent of that in terms of like flooding the market to fill a gap.
Yeah.
When the artist decides that he's basically trying to, you know, lay down, the label doesn't want to know about it. So they go out of their way to basically keep you in the public eye by recycling stuff. So here we have the Eric Clapton album released in August of 1970. And a couple of years later comes out an album called Clapton with a picture of him from about the exact same era with the exact same haircut. It's a close-up of him probably in the exact same photo. And the album contains, you know, at least four of the songs from the album Eric Clapton. So it really...
No shame.
Right. It was like, companies. You know, you can't blame Clapton because he was like totally, you know, laying back from the music scene at this point. Frankly, this is when he was suffering from his addiction. It was at its worst. We should get to it. But at this point in time in 1970, he's happy, he's active, and this is the material that ends up being the most recycled and would cause confusion later on. But the album that is the real genuine article, you should remember, is it's called Eric Clapton, and on the cover you see him seated on what looks like an ordinary sort of a chair with a Fender guitar leaning against his right leg, just sitting there with his arms folded in front of him. And it's simply entitled Eric Clapton. Not Clapton, not Clapton at his best, not the history of Eric Clapton, but just Clapton. Eric Clapton, excuse me. See there, now I'm getting confused.
Easily done.
Let's play two more tracks from this album before we move on. One is a track titled Told You for the Last Time, a pretty cool song written by Delaney and Bonnie with Steve Cropper, the guitar player Steve Cropper. And the other track that Clapton said is the only song that he brought to the session prepared before they started to record, which is the song Let It Rain. Here they are back to back.
Well, I've told you for the last time. Sometimes, 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 sometimes,
it rain, let it rain, let your love rain down on me. Let it rain, let it rain, let it rain.
Eric Clapton, he was rightly proud of finally coming to terms with what he wanted to do musically and releasing his first solo album. But nevertheless, he became, you know, homesick for England. He had just bought that gorgeous house that he was calling Hurtwood, and here he was really, like, you know, crashing at people's houses around California, various spots in California, to record this album with Delaney and Bonnie, and it was only natural that he would go back home, which is what he ended up doing. When he was there, of course, you know, he had relationships with other women, but this is like his like obsession with George Harrison's wife, Patty, was just getting deeper and deeper, and it became something of a serious distraction that was pretty much on his mind. Even in his own book, he writes about it to some to a great extent, about how that was more or less, you know, occupying almost all of his thoughts, and he was having a hard time sublimating it. At one point, though, I'll read again from the book. I'd had a call from Carl Radel telling me that Delaney and Bonnie and friends had disbanded.
Wow.
And asking me whether I might be interested in doing something with him, Bobby Whitlock, and Jim Gordon. In other words, the band was suddenly totally free to become his band.
Right.
Having nothing else on, I'd said yes. And they flew over to England and came to live at Hurtwood. It was the beginning of one of the most extraordinary periods of my life, the memory of which is dominated by one thing, incredible music. It began with me just talking to these guys about music and getting to know them, and then we just played and played and played. I would be in absolute awe of these people, and yet they made me feel that I was on their level. My musicianship fit with their musicianship. We were kindred spirits, made in the same mold. To this day, I would say that the bass player Carl Radel and the drummer Jimmy Gordon are the most powerful rhythm section I have ever played with. They were absolutely brilliant. When people say that Jim Gordon is the greatest rock and roll drummer who ever lived, I think it's true, beyond anybody.
All we did was jam and jam and jam, and night would become day and day would become night, and it just felt good to me to stay that way. I had never felt so musically free before. We kept ourselves going with fry-ups and a cocktail of drink and drugs, mostly cocaine and Mandrax. Mandy's were quite strong sleeping pills, but instead of letting them put us to sleep, we would ride the effect, staying awake by snorting some coke or drinking some brandy or vodka. And this would create a unique kind of high. This became the chemistry of our lives, mixing all of these things together. God knows how our bodies stood it. I had no game plan at this time. We were just enjoying playing, getting stoned and writing songs. George Harrison was a frequent caller. He had recently moved from Kinfounds, his bungalow in Esher, to a sprawling mansion in Henley called Friar Park, and his visits gave me plenty of opportunity to flirt with Patty behind Paula's back, his other girlfriend. One night I called up Patty and told her the truth, quote-unquote, that it was not Paula I was interested in or any other girl she might see me with, but that she was the one I really wanted. In spite of her protests that she was married to George and that what I was suggesting was impossible, she agreed to my coming over to talk to her. I drove over there and we talked about it over a bottle of red wine and ended up kissing, and I sensed for the first time that there was some kind of hope for me. I knew then what I had suspected for some time, that all was not well in her marriage. I was so buoyed up by what had happened with Patty, as well as being a bit drunk, that on the way home, driving a little Ferrari Dino that I just bought, I took a corner and climbed in much too fast and hit a fence, and the car flipped over onto its roof. I didn't pass out, but I found myself just hanging there upside down. Somehow I undid the seatbelt and got out, and realizing that I didn't even have a driver's license, made the decision to run home and make out that someone had stolen the car. So I set off running, but soon realized that I was heading in the wrong direction, back toward London.
Oops.
I then thought that I would hide somewhere, so I opened a gate in the hedge, walked into what turned out to be a graveyard, and sat down on a grave. After a while, I decided to go back and face the music. I walked back to where the car was, and all these people wearing dressing gowns were wandering around with torches looking for the driver. I owned up that it was me. Someone had already called an ambulance, and it arrived straight away and took me to Guildford Hospital for a checkup. Then Bobby Whitlock came and took me home. Miraculously for me, I was unhurt, and luckily, the police never got involved.
Wow, that is lucky.
So here's an example of what was going on, though, in this wind. They were working, Eric is working with this group, and they had some material. Here's an example of like a jam session of what they were doing before it was technically really Derek and the Dominoes, the name they would eventually choose for themselves. Here is literally what is called Tell the Truth, as he had said, needing to tell, quote-unquote, the truth to Patty.
Mm-hmm.
The jam version. It's 9 minutes long, so settle in. We'll be right back.
there's the jam version, Tell the Truth. Now, I call that stuff usually if you're liking what you're doing, you hone it down, you figure out that you can turn it into a tight song, make up a couple of words. Clapton had the phrase based upon what was going on in his head with what he needed to do. Another song inspired by Patty Harrison, technically, about how he felt the need to tell the truth. And they were able to come up with a tight arrangement that was about 3.5 minutes long. And it was decided that this would become the very first single released under the name Derek and the Dominoes, featuring Clapton with Carl Radel, Jim Gordon, and Bobby Whitlock. Produced by Phil Spector, because this was recorded around the same time that George Harrison was working with Phil Spector in England. So they recorded this at Trident Studios with Phil doing the production.
Interesting.
Here's the single version then of that exact same song, Tell the Truth.
Tell the truth. Tell me who's been fooling you. Tell the truth. Now who's been fooling you?
That's 3.5 minutes versus the previous version, which was 9 minutes.
More concise.
I think it's also because it's so much more manic.
Yeah.
You know, they're playing it so much more quickly that you only need a third of the time to get it all in. Well, it was scheduled to be the first single. I think it might have been released, but subsequently, for one reason or another, it was recalled. So they didn't keep it out there on the market. Mm. There's one other song that basically dates from this exact era. Again, I'll let Eric Clapton himself set it up. George was working on his first solo album, All Things Must Pass, and one day he asked if the Tulsa guys and I would play on it. I knew he had Phil Spector producing for him, so he made a deal whereby he would get Spector to produce a couple of tracks for us in return for having the use of our band for his album. After my dalliance with Ronnie Renette, who had later told me how much I reminded her of her husband, I was curious to meet Phil Spector and noticed that we actually did have the same kind of facial profile. We recorded two songs with him, Roll It Over and Tell the Truth, at Abbey Road Studios before turning ourselves over to George as his session musicians. Here's that other track then that was recorded with Phil Spector producing around the exact same time as George Harrison's All Things Must Pass. This is called Roll It Over. right, then. Rather strange topic there for a song. Roll It Over by Derek and the Dominoes. Again, one of the songs that was recorded as George Harrison was preparing his own album, All Things Must Pass. Now, one ingredient was missing in the band, and that was, although there, that track might have been something to suggest it, because on that track, Eric Clapton is joined on guitar by not only George Harrison, but also Dave Mason. They're both playing guitar with Eric Clapton on that track, and it probably got Eric to thinking that maybe he didn't need to be the only guitar player having all of that weight on him alone. And again, reading directly from the book, from his autobiography, one night our producer Tom Dowd told me that the Allman Brothers Band was playing the Coconut Grove and suggested that we all go down to see them. With their long, long hair and beards, the band looked amazing, and they were great musicians. I loved them, but what really blew me away was Duane Allman's guitar playing. I was mesmerized by him. He was very tall and thin, with an air of complete conviction, and although he didn't sing, I felt sure he was the leader of the band, just by his body language. Tom introduced us to the band after the show, and we invited them back to the studio for a jam, which resulted in me asking Duane to play on the sessions while they were in town. Duane and I became inseparable during the time we were in Florida, and between the two of us, we injected the substance into the Layla sessions that had been missing up to that point. He was like the musical brother I'd never had but wished I did. Here's an example of how that began to work on a duet, actually, a song written by Walter Jacobs, a blues called Mean Old World, with Eric Clapton on vocals and guitar and Duane Allman, the only other instrumental player, on guitar. We'll end with this track. We'll join you next week as we come back and we discuss the album Layla and Other Assorted Love Songs with Derek and the Dominoes. See you then, folks. Take care.
Listen to me, no world. Try to live it by yourself. So cool. Gets you don't love me. I'm gonna pack my things and